Good evening, everyone. This is Diane Mitchell Hamilton on the line, and I'm joined by my good friends and my integral colleagues, Terry Patton and Jeff Salzman. And for our integral living room conversation, we like to sort of tap into what seems to be getting a lot of energy in the media and see if there's a way that by opening up a topic that we're able to maybe bring an integral perspective or an integral lens and see if there are any dimensions to our conversation that we're able to explore and to express that maybe, you know, aren't as easily addressed in the news sources that we all tap into. So this week, you know, for us, there are a number of different topics that are alive, but the Trayvon Martin case in the States, of course, has, you know, taken on a tremendous amount of energy, and most recently Barack Obama, you know, basically said some quite poignant things from his perspective about the issue of Trayvon Martin. And I think just to create some context, I'm going to ask Jeff Salzman just to say a couple things about, most of you I'm sure are quite aware of what happened, but just in terms of the actual specifics, maybe just what happened and what the legal question was for George Zimmerman in terms of the laws in Florida. And then he's going to just hand it back to me quickly, and I'm going to create a kind of context in which we want conversation to happen. So we're going to bring some historical, developmental, and also some kind of four quadrant considerations to the conversation. I want to thank everybody for being on the call, for taking the time out. Sometimes in the integral community, we don't have as many robust conversations around issues of race relations and ethnic bias and, you know, just fundamentally our differences that we might in other contexts that all of us have worked in. So we think it's a nice time to be able to do that. I want to give Jeff and Terry both an opportunity to say hi. Terry, maybe let me go to you first. You can just say hi and place yourself on the call, and then I'll throw it over to Jeff. So welcome again, everybody. Hi, Terry.
Hi. It's great to be here. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. I'm excited to dig into this painful topic that I wanted to avoid. I'm the one who argued against having this topic, and therefore I'm sure it'll be especially fruitful for me.
Awesome. Jeff Salzman, hi.
Hi, Di. Hi, Terry. Hi, everybody. Yeah, let me just sort of fill in the basic facts of the story as we know them. This is the last week there was a not guilty verdict found for George Zimmerman, who was a 28-year-old married man who was a neighborhood watch coordinator in Florida in a development of about 200 to 300 homes, kind of a middle-class development in a northern Florida, small city in northern Florida. And this happened about a year and a half ago, 7 o'clock at night. It's a rainy night, February. It's dark. And George Zimmerman notices a young black man, Trayvon Martin, walking through the neighborhood. Trayvon is walking back to his home where he's living with his father in the development. He had been to the 7-Eleven. He had a Coke and some Skittles and was walking back home. He was approached by Zimmerman, who was armed, and he got into an altercation, the details and facts of which are in play in this trial. And the final act was that Zimmerman shot Martin through the chest and killed him. And what was notable about the case, extra notable, was that Zimmerman got off and was several weeks without any notice until there were demonstrations and a new prosecutor was brought in, and there were charges of murder brought against Zimmerman. And so the case really revolved around what actually happened. And there are lots of facts and lots of theories, and that is the legal story of this case. And we can talk about that to the degree that people want to. And everybody has an opinion, and you can see the conservative storyline is that Zimmerman is a good man who was protecting his neighborhood, which had been in a crime spree. And so, you know, he was doing what a good man does, which was protect his community and his family. And there's the more liberal storyline that emphasizes the victimization of Trayvon Martin, who was doing absolutely nothing wrong, walking through the neighborhood. And we notice how our minds grip around these stories. And this is an interesting perspective. It's an interesting self-observation for integralists to do that. So that's the story of the facts of the case. The bigger story, of course, is that this incident, this tragedy, so perfectly captures one of the gnarliest issues of American culture, and that is the echoes of slavery, which is sometimes referred to as the original sin of American history, and is so very alive still, even though we can see the evolution of, you know, basic civilization and humanity through our history, often hard fought and hard won. It's still very much alive. And so this is the bigger story, and it's what is also very engaging to us as integralists. And Di, maybe I throw it back to you, and you could talk a little bit about your insights into particularly this part of it.
Well, just in terms of creating a kind of evolutionary context, I just happened to be with Ken on Thursday and spent a couple of hours with him in the afternoon, and he was the one that prompted me to contextualize this, you know, what will become an iconic incident, you know, the death of this young black man and all the questions surrounding his death, you know, basically in the evolution of culture. And Ken reminded me that, you know, slavery was practiced all over the world as basically an outgrowth of the agricultural phase of human evolution, and that when machines came along and industrialization happened, within a very short period of time, slavery was actually outlawed, and the United States was caught. It was a very kind of inelegant and incongruent evolution for the United States. Half the country was still agrarian. The other half of the country became industrial. It wasn't that people particularly developed a moral conscience. It's simply that there was the capacity to let machines do the work, and suddenly it didn't make any sense now to hold, you know, other human beings in this kind of servitude. And yet the Civil War erupted over this enormous chasm in human development, and, you know, the pain of that and the legacy of the ongoing oppression of people of color in the South, and then also throughout the rest of the country, has just been, in a certain way, one of the things that we've inherited. So Ken was really encouraging us to realize that we're, you know, we're participating in the evolution of culture, and that, you know, we're still in it. It's not resolved. It's still happening. It's devastating, painful, difficult. We each have both, you know, the part of the country we're in, we have our personal experience, we have, you know, whether or not we're ethnic minorities or whether we're in a white majority, whether we're Northern European by descent, you know, whether we're African, of African descent or another ethnic minority, and that basically that shapes our experience. And the question is, you know, can we have a conversation? Because even while we may not be able to liberate the conditions of this legacy of incredible oppression, conversation is one of the ways that we can actually start to liberate one another and also lift our hearts. I heard somebody say during the Clinton administration that, you know, race bias was alive and well. There was still lots of incidents of inequity, of prejudice, of oppression. But the one thing that had happened is that people had actually gotten better at talking about it. So I argued for talking about it because I feel that within our community, even though at most of our gatherings there's just a you know, preponderance of white folks, you know, we're all world-centric at some level. We're all Americans at another level. And each of us in our own lives has had even a tiny experience of not being seen for who we are, not being treated the way we should be treated. And we all have the experience of doing the same to others. From that perspective, there's great commonalities that we need to explore and build on in terms of really, you know, working again to liberate all of our consciousness and then ultimately all of our conditions from, you know, from the legacy of slavery and from the deep ethnocentric bias that runs throughout world culture and which we've all experienced. So that's pretty much a mouthful in terms of, you know, just wanting to locate the conversation, at least in time and space, in that way. And then, Terry, if there's more that you want to say, and then I think we'd like to kind of start to unfold some perspectives and then get some perspectives from you on the call. And I think that we'll certainly have time for you to talk in small groups from each other. I think maybe you want to, we could to some degree, share our cosmic address, but it's also not necessary. You know, we have a question like, you know, is a conversation related to race relations, to ethnic bias, you know, is that a conversation that is interesting to us? We need to have what happens when our numbers, you know, we just simply don't have enough brown people on our call, or we don't have enough people of color. You know, what does that mean? And, you know, I would argue that it's still our conversation, it's still our life experience, and we need to participate in it and maybe disclose to ourselves where we find each other, where we're located in terms of our cosmic address around, you know, these issues that are so, you know, on the one hand, we should be proud of ourselves as humans, we're outgrowing some things, and on the other hand, it's also a devastating and hard conversation to have. So, Terry, I'm gonna send it over to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, wow. Well, this is a very hard conversation for me, my own. I think that what we're dealing with here is our cultural shadow. And our cultural shadow, you know, began with the genocide of the American Indians, and it's proceeded from there. And we tend to want to sit in a third-person relationship to all that and look at it as a quantity and feel kind of clear, and, you know, the 30,000-foot view is the most comfortable view to take on this topic because it's a shadow matter. But the way you do shadow work is to do your own shadow work. And so there's a shadow piece for me to do, a shadow piece for us to do. I don't know, you know, in general, the community of people who come to Integral events is predominantly white. Let's find out on this call. If you self-identify as white, please press 2. And if you self-identify as minority, please press 1. Let's see who we are here. Well, great. We have more people who self-identify as members of a minority than we usually see on our calls. It's 14% of the people on the call have identified as minority, and 70% have identified as white. So we have 16% that haven't identified. So maybe more close to being representative of the general population. I know that one of the issues that comes up for me as I work with this, I grew up in an interracial community, and as a kid I remember feeling like there was us, you know, us good liberals and black people and Japanese people and lefties and kind of civil rights and peace movement folks, and then them were the kind of conservative racist other. That was how I cut the world up. And then as I came into my adult life, I found myself having some rude awakenings when I was a victim sometimes of reverse racism from people of color, when I discovered the basis in behavior for all kinds of ethnic and racial stereotypes, when I discovered the fact that if I really wanted to focus my attention on the growth of my own awareness, I gravitated to communities that were predominantly white. And it felt as though I had to either make that diversity point a real theme of my life in a shaping way, and perhaps not be able to focus as much as I wanted to on my own growth of consciousness, or let it be a secondary issue. And I think that I've always felt some measure of guilt, because I don't think that I've maintained that commitment as front and center as I would have wanted to, or even as I was bred to. And when I look at how this plays itself out in our world, I feel this is a really deep wound, like a family system, where family systems therapist comes, you know, upon a family, and there's maybe the teenage boy is acting out, but they discover that the dysfunction's in the family as a whole, and that the teenage boy is holding the family shadow and is the one through whom the pain is expressing itself. In some sense, we as a whole culture have a system in which, you know, the asymptomatic members of the family claim no responsibility for the pattern that is becoming symptomatic in some, and in particularly minority members. And yet none of us seem to be able to break the pattern. I don't know how to break the pattern. I feel heavy with it. And when I see something like the media focus, the 24/7 kind of cable focus on this trial, you know, I tuned it out because it feels like we rehearse these wounds in ways that maybe slowly move things forward, but which tend, you know, it's like if you are raising money for aid to underprivileged people in other parts of the world, if you can find a conflict where there's a perpetrator and a victim, you can get way more money for it than if you're dealing with something that has to do with drought because of global warming or kind of a victimless crime, you know. Traffic fatalities doesn't raise money. And the dynamic of how our attention gets riveted on something like this trial and then ignores Obama's hugely important climate change speech and initiative really bother me. So I feel like these wounds are part of how we have become less functional, how our culture war has broken us from our ability to do, you know, it's the focus of our shadow, but it's how we don't do our shadow work and how we don't become as functional as we could. So I admit to having a resistance to going here because it's a place of unresolved shadow that where I haven't found my way through to a place that feels entirely satisfying. I think maybe just being real about that is the most dynamic thing I can do to move the conversation to a deeper place.
Fair enough. I also just want to say that talking about shadow work is one way to talk about it, but also just kind of being willing to encounter pain. Encountering pain and encountering a certain kind of unresolvability, at least at this moment. And maybe before we unfold a little more, well, you were about to throw the ball to Jeff. I'd also like to get some other viewpoints from callers on the call. Jeff, do you have anything you want to add right now?
I guess the main thing I would add would be that I don't see it as that none of us know how to break the pattern and that it's unsolvable. This, we're actually solving it. This is what Trayvon Martin, this is what his life's meaning is, and what he brings to the culture is and also George Zimmerman. You know, a young man who, you know, they both have too much testosterone. What, you know, it's hard to sort out the actual, you know, event itself, but the 24/7 news coverage is functional. Even the us versus them, I mean, there's a whole strata of our culture that thinks in terms of us versus them. We know this as integralists. I'm not in despair about that. There's a part of me that is in that strata. And this is part of the shadow work that I get to do and we all get to do, and we can do it with a joyful heart. I mean, this is a practice where we feel in to Trayvon Martin himself, to his mom. I mean, and her, she's this amazing, unbelievable mother and father. And they come from this faith and this passion and this love for their little Trey. I mean, it really brings this little boy alive. And I want to feel that, you know, as a practice. And I want to feel where I've been marginalized. And I want to feel George Zimmerman. And we're all doing that. And we're doing that through the way evolution happens, which is we're contesting, we're conflicting, we're competing. We have dueling storylines here. But this is not a sign of dysfunction. This is a sign of function. So I don't know. I'll just stop there, and we can, you know, see where it goes. But I want to put that on the plate.
Got it. Well, what I would like to do, and it's just as an invitation, is because basically all three of us on the call identify as, you know, white. I would really appreciate hearing from some people now, just some perspectives. We're just gathering perspectives right now. So anybody who identifies as a person of color or identifies as African American, if you would raise your hand and we'll let you get your perspectives out so we can start to weave this conversation. Just to pick up while we're waiting, just to pick up on what Jeff's saying, I think, you know, it's an interesting thing because I do a lot of traveling in the world, as particularly into different interfaith communities. You know, and there's a way that America is viewed to some degree, you know, as having these kind of troubles related to race. But I would also venture to say that I'm going to kind of pick up Jeff's part of the conversation for a minute. I actually feel like there's been an incredible willingness to, like, encounter and deal with things, and it isn't easy by any means, and we're a little bit more sort of out there with where the real struggles are, and we're grappling with it, and so in a certain way, you could say that we're bruised, but at least we're engaged. And so when Europeans or people in other parts of the world, you know, talk about it, I say, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, we're kind of hanging ourselves out there as Americans, I think, and really grappling with these issues in a really explicit way. And for that, I'm really proud of us, because, it's difficult. It's a difficult experience to have. And, you know, then also for me, I just, you know, I was very impressed with President Obama's speech, and I felt like he did something that was kind of massively skillful and somewhat integral. I thought the way that he stepped into the experience and personalized it and talked about, you know, how 30 years ago it could have been him, and just really using his power. I mean, one of the beautiful things about power is using your power to actually work for people who have less power, and to give kind of mainstream America to remind us that what it's like to look through the lens or to have actually been in the African-American experience. Like, it's just absolutely a different lens, and we have to, all of us have to be aware of that, you know, whatever our race and ethnic identity, we need to be aware that we have different experiences, that we're literally having different experiences, and that being reminded of that. And then also he said something else that would go along with what you're saying, Jeff, which is he said that he really feels his children's generation is further along than we are. And I thought that was really powerful. I think that just to get started, you know, just as Terry said, you know, Terry experienced himself on, you know, two sides of this dilemma. So one of the things we can do as intervalists is that we can talk about an issue from a third-person perspective. We can talk about it from a second-person perspective in terms of how we ourselves, the groups we're in, you know, are relating to this. And also we can move into a very deep first-person perspective. So what we're going to do is I'm going to invite Ben. And by the way, thank you, Ben, for being on the call and for supporting us technologically.
Ben Levy.
Ben Levy.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ben Levy, for being on the call. Yeah. I think what we'll do is move into groups of, let's just do groups of two for right now. So what I'm going to ask you to do is to actually access the part of yourself that has, for whatever reason, in whatever moment, you've experienced a certain kind of persecution, or you've experienced race bias, or you've experienced a certain bias in terms of not being seen who you are, which resulted in, you know, whatever it resulted in. I just want us to kind of, from the very inside, tap into the experience of actually being, you know, victimized in terms of just not being treated fairly.
And I think we're going to put them in groups of three, because on these calls, if one person is missing, people just end up alone who want to participate. So it doesn't tend to be good practice to do dyads.
Okay, fair enough. All right, so we're going to go into groups of three. So we're going to give you about 10 minutes to get into groups of three and for everyone on the call to identify with having been in the role of being victimized in a real way. Like, when has that really happened to you, and what was that experience like? And you're each going to have about 2 minutes. We'll give you a minute to transition in and a minute to transition out. So just access that part of the experience, if you would, please. Okay, we'll see you in 10 minutes at 7:40. All right, everybody, it's been 10 minutes, and I want to thank you for just delving into your own first-person experience. Keep in mind, from an integral perspective, what's important about the first-person experience is its sovereignty. So the truth of your experience in terms of what you, the ways in which you have felt oppressed or persecuted or unseen or treated, you know, unfairly or really injured in a particular way. And I hope you were able to access that and share it. Also, keep in mind that the Maestro Conferencing, while it is a really kind of amazing platform, it's imperfect and people often drop off the call. So some of you have dropped off the call, you've gotten back on, and you've been placed back into another group, and it's, chances are it's not the group you were in originally. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take the other side of this first-person perspective, and we're going to identify with the part of ourselves that is the oppressor or is the persecutor, the one who has treated other people unfairly, who's racially profiled others, who has refused to listen to a point of view, who's actively eliminated somebody from your awareness because somehow they weren't worthy of it, who's actually treated people, you know, like really unfairly. We were just talking about the Museum of Tolerance down in L.A., and there are two different doors. There's a door that you walk through if you are free of race bias, and there's a door you walk through if you are not. And when you go to walk through the door of being free of race bias, basically that door is locked. And what it's really pointing to is that we have these really, really powerful ethnocentric dimensions to our consciousness in which us and them is perfectly clear. We know who is us, we know who is them, and them is not okay. So I'm asking you to find that really ethnocentric part of yourself and just talk about a time when you treated another person or group of people with prejudice. Okay? So we'll give you 10 minutes to do the reverse, and then we're going to come back and shift our perspective a little bit more into the cultural domain, get a few more frameworks, and maybe hear some other points of view just on the Trayvon Martin incident. Okay? So we'll see you in 10 minutes. I just want to begin by apologizing for those of you who dropped off the call and then got moved into a different group, because it can be incredibly disorienting when you know, trying to establish yourself online and then suddenly, you know, you're out in the middle of nowhere. So we started by asking you to actually access your own first-person perspective, both in terms of this kind of persecutor and victim polarity, and experiencing the victim part of your consciousness and also the part of you that's oppressive. Can I invite you to maybe share some of your insights or what it was like for you to just simply rest in your first person and identify those two parts of yourself? Do you have anything that you'd like to share from having done that? Okay, Nancy Kent, let's hear from you, Nancy. Go ahead.
Well, I just would like to say that I feel like that's the most important thing we could do as a country is to access both of those parts within each of us and as a culture. I mean, I think that's part of the problem with this whole incident and then the reaction to it and the way the media has been playing it is that we're not accessing both sides within ourselves. We're otherizing it.
Yeah, I think so too. Thanks, Nancy. So let's see. It looks like Val Devon has her hand up, or his hand. Go ahead, Val.
Hi, I'm a she.
Hi, she.
Hi.
Good to know.
I was surprised at the intensity of my emotions that came up on both sides, and the language. That not preparing a speech or anything, but the stuff that would just roll off my tongue was that I was kind of born a privilege here, free, white, and 21, and educated in a nice neighborhood and community and yards to play in and stuff like that. A woman of substance and intelligence and heart, and then to be ignored or devalued or shamed into a place of invisibility where I felt to have been born with all this and then denied access to it. It's like, no, don't go there, don't feel that, don't think that, don't be that, don't show us how smart you are, don't show us how bright and talented you are, don't do all those things that you really are, go live in a cave and or in the old mentality of be barefoot and pregnant. But that same mentality I have felt my whole life, whether from my family of origin and the men, and a lot of times girlfriends, And it's not men and women, it's just people who have, it seems to me, that I am born with all this access to so many wonderful things and then denied access to it. I was born with it, but then denied access.
In what respect exactly do you mean that?
Denied access?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not a scientist or a behaviorist, and so technically, medically, I'm just a person. But to be told, I want to do this with my life, and no, you don't want to do that. It's not of value. Or to want to speak your truth or your heart and then say, no, you shouldn't feel that way.
Yes,
and,
yes.
Or, you know what I'm saying? A denied access to my truth, capital S, self, with a capital S, is denied access to validate, encourage, identify, to be seen, for someone to see that part of me and or refuse to see it. The painful piece here is how it's been denied, how I show it, and they can't see it. They can't see it and don't want to see it. There's no room for it.
That's a little bit of what President Obama was stressing in his speech when he said, you know, that when we look at the disparate, you know, because one of the things that comes up is that there is a disproportionate amount of crime in the black community with some African American young men, and how do we actually address that issue? And President Obama basically said there is a reason for it. It's not a justification, but there's simply a reason. And so that to be able to realize that inability to be seen, to be valued, to be supported has ramifications, you know, whether it's in your life as a female or whether it's in their lives. And but that's precisely his point, is we've got to actually acknowledge that we at least have to see how that plays. So thanks a lot for your comment.
Yes, thank you. There's one other piece that you reminded me that some famous something said that in the heart of every little boy, he would rather steal first base than a car.
Thank you. So, Ben, do you want to go ahead?
Certainly. Thanks, Diane. So I read this wonderful piece, and I wanted to bring in this frame because it was a different frame than what we've been talking about so far. This was written by a gentleman named Ben Hunt, who's a behavioral economist writing about the economy and the stock market, but he mentioned the Zimmerman trial this way, and this is how he framed it. And I would just like to toss out this inquiry, and that is, if Zimmerman had been found guilty of murdering Trayvon Martin, would we be having the conversation that we're having right now? That's an inquiry. I'm not sure we would be, because our expectations would have been met. Our expectations of this individual case as related to this larger case about race and about guns and all of that would have been in alignment with our beliefs. We would have had a congruence about it. But in this case, this specific case of this trial was incongruent. The outcome of the case was incongruent with our beliefs about, you know, social justice. And this gentleman, Ben Hunt's comment is that the way that trials are structured is that they're all about this individual particular case. And the people that thought that the trial was a tragedy or a travesty were focusing on the social injustice and not necessarily on the particulars of the trial. And his comment is that we do this all the time, is that we think an individual case is actually representative of this larger social case, but it isn't always the case that this is true. And I just wanted to bring that perspective in because I found it a fascinating one. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in a certain way, you could say that the case is actually playing in two different domains. So it's playing in a legal domain in which the very particulars of the case and the way in which the law is and the make of the judge and the jury, that's all very specific. But that the case also has reality within the social context, so that there are actually two cases. There are many cases, actually. There's the legal case, and there's the particulars, but then there's the way that the perfect storm of particulars actually raises it to a new level in which it starts to have meaning beyond the limits of the individual particulars. So it actually is functioning in the same way, you know, you could say in the same way that when Rosa Parks sat at the back of the bus, that individual act carried a tremendous amount of meaning across the, because of the timing and the specifics, and going back even further, the incident with Emmett Till that really, in a certain way, catapulted the civil rights movement from the very beginning. These are iconic moments in which the particulars become both social and very symbolic, precisely because of their cosmic address, so to speak.
Yeah,
so Jeff, you have a few other things you wanted to say. You want to go ahead, Jeff?
Address the comment, Ben, that you brought up, or this writer brought up, about what if George Zimmerman had been found guilty? Would we be having this conversation? And to me, the answer would be yes, we would be having, it'd be a different conversation, but we'd be having one. And I think the idea that it went the way we thought it should go is true for liberals. It's not true for conservatives. Conservatives had a different victim in this storyline. And this is George Zimmerman, who was protecting his community and family. And, you know, they have a storyline that makes perfect sense in the physics of their psyches. And so that would be the conversation we'd be having. But the sense that it would be that the outcome was congruent with our moral intuition is not true for everybody. I just want to point that out. And as integralists, I think we want to see a couple things, actually. One is that, you know, when we really get to the particulars of this case, and that is who did what when and all of the, you know, the actual tragedy itself, there's a certain place where we get to, I don't know. There's a not knowing mind is actually a potent place to be. And it's hard to hold. But I think we can, I mean, I certainly have gotten to the point, having heard the evidence and the testimony and so forth, that there's a big part of me that just, I don't know what happened. And then there's the, you know, the cultural dimensions that I think is the part that we work with as integralists, where we want to be friendly with all of these points of view and realize that they actually have a place and they actually have a piece of the truth that the other point of view is missing. And I just add one more thing, and that is, you know, I may just be talking about the difference between amber traditionalists here, the conservative Republicans, the Fox News people, and the MSNBC people, the Democracy Now! People, the liberals. But there's also a big swath in there of people who are center of gravity modernists, and you can see that how their point of view was playing out was in the legal system itself, where there's this, you know, sort of relentless and in some ways stultifying and numbing, plotting kind of, let's just get to the truth without, with, you know, having justice be as blind as possible to these other two competing storylines. And that, you know, facts and evidence and stacking it up and judges and juries, that this is, you know, a great achievement of humanity, that we would have this kind of a system as imperfect as it is. So I just throw that out there as well.
I'd like to bring in something a little different. I wonder if this begins to edge us up against something else, which has to do with our own shadows, maybe in our own local community. Like, is there a way that contemplating this dynamic and this disowned part and the way that that tends to be a wound in the psyche of us as a culture, are there ways that that provokes awareness of wounds that are in our shared culture, in this subculture where we know one another, where we have discourse? I wonder if this broadens things a little. Also, I see some people's hands up. Hi, Nancy.
Okay.
You're on.
Hi. This is an interesting conversation, and I kind of go to a very different, I wouldn't say different place, I kind of go to the edge in this for me is something around certainly seeing different points of view and seeing different perspectives, and yet I get up to a place of impatience where something around not wanting to whitewash it all or make it all a wash. Or I don't want to be polarized in a situation, but neither do I want to find myself just sort of throwing up my hands and saying, oh, well, it doesn't matter which point of view I have in the matter. And
so
how would you
do that in this moment? How would you not whitewash it? What would you need to speak to in order to keep it alive and real for you in a way that doesn't just flatten it all out and reduce it?
I guess for me, it's around the violence piece, because I think for me that's the piece that I really have some difficulty with is. And maybe it's just because when I was speaking, what came up for me was having the conversation as a Canadian and how we have a very different perspective around guns than the Americans do. We really do. We just really do.
And yes, we don't. Yes, you do.
Yeah, I mean, we really do.
Yeah.
And how does that play in this moment in relationship to this issue? Like, what do you
find? Because I just don't relate at all to that need to have that, you know, I have to have the right to bear arms. I just don't have that need. It's not in my culture. It's not a part of my culture. It's not how, you know, I know there are people in our culture who think it is, but it's mostly comes from the American culture and the people that have, you know, Canadians just don't have that in them in that way. And I don't know what it is. It's just that right or that need to have to bear arms isn't a part. And so it brings up stuff in me. It brings up kind of this, what is that? I don't even understand that. It makes me frustrated. It makes me angry. It makes me, like, I you know, want to say, get real, people, smarten up, you know. And then I realize that's my own aggression coming out.
Well, it's also your ethnocentrism. That's precisely the point, is there's a moment where we just experience a difference and we experience a boundary. And not only do we experience the boundary, but we interestingly enough, we find ourselves feeling superior, right? That's exactly the point, is that where that boundary is, we're somehow superior to the one on the other side, right?
No, I don't go to a, well, I sort of do, but I don't. You know, I do, but I just, it's more a lack of real understanding of the need. And I kind of just get to this place of, what is that? Why? And then, and the futility of that, and the frustration of feeling the futility of that, because I recognize that lots of people have that stance. You know, I don't deny that. I don't have any problem with them, you know, whatever, if that's their choice, I suppose. But on the other hand, it doesn't make me comfortable when I feel there's lots of people out there bearing arms against one another. So to me,
I could take a stab at it.
That doesn't make me feel real happy in any way.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I'd take a stab at it. First of all, I'd say that, you know, we can discern that a culture with less gun violence is better, more superior. It's better. It's less suffering than a culture that has a lot of gun violence. And we do have a lot of gun violence. And that's something that we take a look at, because every culture and every country has its own personality, its own enneatype. And our enneatype, for a lot of reasons, is probably something around a 3 and an 8. We're also, you guys in Canada were more or less settled by the Northern Europeans, and they've always been a step ahead. They still are in terms of green culture. And when you get to green and integral, this is how integral carries some of the healthy aspects of green forward, is there's a repulsion. There's a moral, you know, I get it, Nancy, that there's a repulsion to what is with these guns, people, you know. But then if you get to a amber traditionalist stage of development, you realize that people, it's just like my cousins back in Pennsylvania. I grew up in the God and Guns people in Western Pennsylvania. Everybody hunted. Everybody had guns. My cousins, my family, all had guns. And I was talking to a cousin of mine at a wedding a couple years ago, and he was talking about his guns. And I just mentioned, I don't have a gun. And he said, well, thank God you're single and don't have any family, because if you did, I'd cuff you in the head.
Oh,
because his point is, His point is, and this is real for him, is that I'm responsible. I'm ultimately responsible for my family's safety. I can't trust the police. And we have a long history in humanity where the police were not benign forces, where they were coming to sort out justice, and that the king and the warlord, you know, whatever it may be in human history, to actually get to that place where I can say, I am sovereign, you can't touch me, is an achievement. There's stages beyond that that, you know, I'd like to think that we inhabit. But in order to wrap our heads around the gun culture, we have to just feel into it and see that they have an argument that makes perfect sense to them.
Oh, I get the mentality behind it. I just don't appreciate it. There's a difference.
Fair enough. Yeah.
I don't appreciate it because I think that it's mentality that is going to cause self-destruct. And I don't stand for that.
Well, but let me just challenge you on that. So one part of you doesn't stand for it, but I'm still going to assert, like I did a few minutes ago, that that mentality that doesn't want to stand for it is the exact same mentality that comes to bear in race relations issues when one ethnocentric culture just can't find a way to identify with the way of being of another culture. It's the same exact phenomenon. So there's a complexity there. It's like on the one hand, Jeff's arguing and you're saying that it's superior, and on the other hand, it's the exact same dynamic. But it's the exact same dynamic that's at play in...
There is nothing in me that thinks it's superior. There's nothing in me
that's
not true. Yeah, but I'm saying there's a boundary here. There's an ethnocentric boundary. There's an us and a them, and there is a sense that within my usness that somehow my view is correct. And we
you asked me if there was something that would be okay for me not to whitewash this. And this is a place where, like, not to whitewash it.
I don't want to whitewash it either. I'm not going to whitewash it either. So that's
I don't think that it's good to. I don't think it's good to just throw up your hands and say, "Well, that's just the way it is." It's good to question.
Well, can I just jump off from that really quickly? And that is that. I need 30 seconds. I think it's really important pivot point in our development where we can say this is the way this is, and we can be actually friendly and understand other people's point of view from their perspective, look at the world through their eyes, and have it not be that means then that it's okay, or there's nothing we can do about it, or that we throw up our hands. That we can do both things, that we can hold and take other perspectives and still see that actually it is superior to have less gun violence, that we want to actually take stands, that we want to be, that we have to vote. If we were on the jury, we'd have to vote. You know, we'd have to rule. And that we have to make decisions and be passionate about them at the same time we're holding everybody as precious.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Complex.
Yep.
A complex thing to do. But worthy. Yeah. Nancy, thanks a lot. Joe, go ahead. I called on you a few minutes ago.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Hi. If I could, I guess I'd start with a joke, which I think bears on what we were just talking about there. I saw this on Facebook, but it said, still waiting for the NRA to say that if Trayvon Martin had a gun, he'd still be with us today.
Oh, man. That's a good joke. And I wouldn't be surprised if it happens.
Wow. Wow. Monica, good question. How about you? Thanks, Joe. Is there more?
On the Wall Street comment, that's kind of where I came off with my son. When he asked me about this and how I felt, and he was expecting the big liberal argument from me. And I said, you know, it doesn't bother me that Zimmerman was acquitted because I don't see what good it would do to have him in jail. You know, that as far as I'm concerned, much of our quote-unquote justice system is about revenge. And, you know, him being in jail would not bring Trayvon back. And I don't know how much it would convince other people not to do what he did. And I really don't think he would ever do it again, I hope, you know, after what he's been through. And you know, to President Obama's point about getting out of the cycle of violence, part of that is to put more money into prevention, you know, keeping people, giving people alternatives to violence rather than punishing them for it when they fall into it.
Right on, man.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. There's a ton
well
of
put.
Hands up. There are a ton of hands up, I just have to say.
I'm gonna
do my best here to be fair, even though it's impossible to be fair. So let's see. Isaac, go ahead.
I have a question about the evolution of justice, and to me, I wonder if Zimmerman going to jail or whatever the sentence would have been justice for a life loss, and can we get to a point where when things happen, we our justice system or our cultural opinions are to heal the past, and where does that fit on an evolutionary scale as opposed to, you know, an eye for an eye and so forth? And that's what, to me, when I watch the news, that's what I feel like everybody's kind of going for.
Jeff, you want to respond to that?
Well, yeah. I mean, most of our history, you know, it used to be, I mean, actually, an eye for an eye was progress. Because it was before that was, you know, I'll knock your eye out if I want to and if I can. And I'll take your wife and I'll take your stuff. And the Ten Commandments came along and the Old Testament, you know, teachings about, you know, payback and retribution. And then there's, you know, a new, in when we move from that sort of a civilization of red into blue where we, or amber, where we see that there's a transcendent justice, there's a transcendent good and transcendent bad, evil. And the justice is mine, saith the Lord, or vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. So it's, you no longer have to worry about getting vengeance on this person or punishing them, because I'm going to take care of it in the afterlife. And that's another huge step forward. And so, you know, our legal system, you know, the people on the right still have a lot of the you know, justice is about punishing. And justice is about, you know, some sort of a payback and a retribution, and also the idea that this will help deter other criminals. And I think there's truth to all of that. And then there's a stage of development, and I think you just expressed it, or the caller before, and I sort of resonate with it. It's just, I personally can't get it up to want to punish people. Period. Now, I'm not sure that, you know, I'm the way it ought to go. Well, I'm sure that's not the way it's going to go. But there's an awareness. You can see it even with this case is just bringing the conversation forward of how many black men are imprisoned and for what. And the distinctions between violent crime and white-collar crime. And how it's being punished and how it's being put through the system. And the more light we shed on this, you know, there's a natural updraft of wisdom and compassion and intelligence that just comes in the system that, you know, I think we're actually, this case is really helping us move forward enormously. And that it was on 24/7 and, you know, people are talking about it is just so much the engine of evolution itself.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Isaac. Monica, good pasture, go ahead, please.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that I feel sometimes is I feel like, why does it have to be an issue of race? You know, and I think, well, you know, we have the jury, and then we have, and then on both, you know, and then everybody is receiving death threats, you know, based on the outcome, based on, you know, what happened in terms of the outcome of the trial, that he was found not guilty based on what, you know, based on one perspective that they were looking at. And I don't know. I mean, I haven't really followed the trial. But I also think that, you know, when it came to back in 1980, when this one truck driver, a white truck driver, was beaten, and there was a jury there, they did not commit, but even though they had videos of the people, of the black men involved, the jury would not convict based on the issue of race. And, you know, so it feels like, you know, it feels like there's this black power and nobody's standing up for this truck driver. And then on the other hand, nobody's standing up for the jury and nobody's standing up for the family that's receiving death threats. And so, you know, and everything is like fuel to the fire, and I don't understand it. It just feels like there's so many contradictions. I wish it wasn't about race at all.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That would be great if it weren't. Yeah, thanks, Monica. So we've got just about 2 minutes left, so I just guess I'll just toss the ball back to Terry to see if you have any kind of closing remarks, and Jeff, whether you have any, and then I'll wrap up and we'll call it a night.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody, I just want to say that I think this gives me a chance not just to reflect on all the many, you know, perspectives that have been raised, but to feel something painful together. And I think there's actually something that goes on. There is a healing that takes place in a psychotherapeutic session when people admit what they feel and when they sit with the pain. If you have a family where somebody's holding the shadow and then that pain is spoken and felt, you know, there's healing in that. Awareness itself is the healer. There's an aspect of this that has been kind of frustrating and painful, but I think there's a healing in it. And I definitely resonate with the perspective Jeff has raised, that we are advancing evolution through this process, even though often it just seems like a rehearsal of stuck positions. And so I guess I just want to appreciate that and appreciate everybody for joining us for this conversation.
Thank you.
And I just close by saying, yeah, right on, Terry, and did feel like we did in this call what we're talking about, as sort of awkward as it is, and it's, you know, this phone technology and so forth. And I want to point out that this call is in advance of a program we're doing, which is about having difficult and fruitful and exciting and creative conversations with other people who are flying at an integral altitude on a good day. And this is the Integral Living Room that Diane and Terry and I are hosting at the Boulder Integral Center here in Boulder, Colorado, starting Halloween night, October 31st, and going through November 3rd. It's a weekend. You can check it out at integrallivingroom.com, and I'm sure there's a link to it on your reminder emails for this call. But the whole point of that event is to have these kinds of conversations with each other, and we're going to use different kinds of conversation technology, this phone one being one of the most difficult in a way, but still quite fruitful. So I just encourage you to consider coming and joining us for this, and we will be having calls periodically, roughly monthly, between now and October to continue to just look at current events and what's up in the culture.
And much more than current events, I want to add. There's an aspect of deep sharing and the most powerful conversations that we have that are not necessarily topical and focused on current events that sometimes I think are the especially most rich ones that we can have. And I hope our next call will be topical in a different way, and certainly when we get together, we'll be focusing in on the kinds of conversations that we can only have with integral friends.
For my part in closing, what I want to say is that I worked for 2 years with the facilitator for a Commission on Racial and Ethnic Fairness in the Justice System in the state of Utah, and my current husband was the Chief Justice, and we worked with he was the chairman along with an African-American judge and also American Indian judge, and we also had representation throughout the criminal justice system. And I just really do want to, I kind of want to take the Barack Obama moment and just say that this, our justice system is simply fraught with race bias. It just is, from top to bottom. And at the same time, there are also many, many good people of all different, you know, ethnic origins, including, you know, European Americans, who are really working to liberate the system from that kind of bias. It really is this complex thing that Nancy and Jeff were getting at, which is there is this potentiality of being more and more free from this kind of bias, and we have to be rigorously honest with ourselves about what the status quo is. And I just really appreciate all of you for taking time out of your, you know, out of your evening and your busy life, and just bringing your heart and, you know, engaging what is sometimes a challenging conversation, but one that we need to have, and one that I also think we're getting better at. So thanks, everybody. It's been really awesome. Thanks for your time again, and we'll see you down the road. Bye, everybody.